So this is the sixth session of our exploration of class, state, and ideology. Last time we were grappling with the problem of how could you possibly coherently construct a theory of the epical trajectory of history, this extraordinarily ambitious kind of theory that Marx was at least implicitly working on. It's important, I think, again, to remember that there's very few places where Marx announces in any straightforward way all of this fits together within some grand narrative of the overall history of human civilization from its very beginnings to the present and into the future. There are places where Marx says this explicitly, other places where it's very close to explicit. It's just embedded very transparently in the argument. But most of Marx's work is not a component of a theory of history, even if it has that as its shadow framework. Still, Marxists and the Marxist tradition has anchored itself in many times and in many ways in that broad theoretical attempt, and that's why I think it's worthwhile for us to deconstruct it, figure out its components and how it works. So it's an incredibly ambitious project. Cohen, I think, is the theorist who has attempted most systematically to lay bare what must be the structure of that theory in order for it to be a coherent theory. So one way to read the book is not so much an actual defense of Karl Marx's theory of history, although the book is called that, and it is. I mean, that's the rhetoric of it. But rather, it's an explication of what the theory must be like in order for it to be defendable. And then it's a separate matter whether the empirical evidence and the, you know, nature of the way the world actually works supports that theory. And Cohen's central argument is that at the very core, the animating, driving element of this theory is functional explanations. And that's why we began spending some time explaining what a functional explanation is. And just one more preliminary comment. Even if, in the end, we feel this is not a satisfactory way of building a general theory of history, or a theory of general history, I think one might want to say, it's worth figuring out functional explanations, because they are constantly present in social theory, sometimes illegitimately, sometimes with pretty good grounding, but always, I think, vulnerable. That is, they are always worthy of careful interrogation to see what's really going on when somebody says the function of the state is X, the role of ideology is Y. Those kinds of statements all imply some sort of functional thinking about it. Okay, so where we ended up last time, I think, was just finishing point two under Roman numeral three, about the structure of functional explanations. I think we ended with my favorite example from social theory, from social explanations, Malinowski's explanation of why the Trobriand Islanders had elaborate fishing rituals when they were out in the dangerous open sea, but no rituals whatsoever when they fished in the lagoon. And the argument was that the rituals were necessary in order to reduce the fear of people going out to sea, and reducing fear was necessary for them to engage in deep sea fishing, and deep sea fishing was necessary to provide the protein needs of the Trobriand Islanders. So there's a sequence of little functional connections in that argument. The Trobriand Island case is interesting because it would lead to a prediction. If the technologies of fishing change dramatically, one would expect a gradual deterioration in the amount of resources people would devote to what is, after all, an expensive, time-consuming activity, rituals. And indeed, that's what I'm told has been the case. Although, of course, there's plenty of other reasons why, as westernization and modernization occurred, and as the autonomy of the Trobriand culture began to deteriorate for other reasons, why fishing rituals might have declined anyway. So it's not knockdown proof, but of course in social science, it's rarely the case that you have evidence that isn't subject to alternative explanations. A few more specifications and clarifications around the idea of functional explanation. First is the, now we're at point three in the outline. Oh, actually, let's take a pause. I said at the beginning of each lecture, there'd be a time for anyone to ask questions that are leftovers from the previous lecture or from readings that you've done. And of course, if you raise a question about the readings, which I'm going to deal with anyway in the lecture, I'll just say so. But does anybody have any question they want to raise? Yeah. Extra outlines. Let's see, I've got two left. It's the same outline as last time. It's not a different... It's the same. The last one was a two-lecture outline. Okay, any questions from leftover questions? Also, as I said at the very beginning of the semester, I think... It's a good idea to write down questions as you read. I think to be asked on the spot, oh yeah, do you remember any question? You know, there's always a certain barrier to entry into the fray of such things. Really, develop the practice of writing down questions you'd like to raise, and don't feel hesitant. We can spend the first 5 or 10 minutes doing this, but it does take a certain initiative for people to feel comfortable doing so. All right, next point is about the distinction between functional and intentional explanations. Functional versus intentional. Functional explanations are often confused with intentional explanations. So we observe that a government policy is beneficial for the capitalist economy, that it shores up the rate of profit, that it stabilizes conditions for capital accumulation. We observe this. And we want to explain why is this the case. Now, a functional explanation says the following. These policies are the way they are because they stabilize the capitalist economy, because they are good for capitalism, because they have those consequences. That's a functional explanation. You explain a structure by its beneficial effects for something else. An intentional explanation is these policies are the way they are because politicians and the social categories to which they are accountable anticipated that these policies would be good for capitalism, believed that these policies would be good for capitalism. They adopted these policies with the intentionally, purposefully, because of what they anticipated would be their effects. Now, the distinction here, therefore, is explaining something by its anticipated effects versus explaining it by its actual effects. Functional explanations explain a structure by its actual consequences. The bones of bird wings are hollow because they actually make flight easier. They actually have the effect of making wings lighter and thus the birds more aerodynamic or whatever. So it's the actual effects in the Darwinian explanation, not the anticipated effects. In fact, that's a key point in Darwin. There are no anticipated effects. There's no teleology. There's no looking into the future to explain why things are the way they are in the present. Yeah.
So are functional explanations like sort of outside of human agency? I mean, are they, if they're not intentional, I've heard the term.
They can be the result of human agency, but the argument goes they're not, they can be a byproduct of human agency, but they are not the purposes of human agency.
Okay. And so how would a functional explanation differ from like a structural explanation, or is that just a different
Well, The two words are often coupled, structural functionalism. But that's because what you're explaining functionally is a structure. And you're explaining how a structure functions by a functional explanation. So structure and function get connected in this terminological way because the explanation is playing off of the two. So consider the following. We observe that capitalist firms are profit-making. Indeed, we observe that by and large, they're not just profit-making, they're at least, they are often behave as if they were profit-maximizing, that they're not just trying to make a profit, they're trying to make as much profit as they can under the constraints that they face. So they're profit-maximizing firms. Now, one view is that this is just because of the intentions of the people who run those firms. They want to make profits. They want to make more profits. Because of their purposes, that's the way the firms behave. So this doesn't have anything to do, it's not a functional explanation. We can explain it entirely by the intentions of the actors. An alternative view is the intentions of the actors are redundant. They're unnecessary to explain the behavior of these firms. You could have capitalist managers and CEOs randomly pick business strategies out of a book. They have a book of possible strategies, and they just randomly pick a strategy. And if you then have an economy like that, eventually all the firms will be profit maximizing. That is, only the strategies which maximize profits will be the ones adopted, that are adopted by firms like that. Only those firms will survive. So that in the end, the world will be populated by profit-maximizing firms, regardless of what the motivations are. Now, if that's a correct diagnosis, then the intentional explanation simply makes the functionalism work more efficiently. You know, there's fewer fatalities among firms than there would have been if it was random. It's a more efficient process by which you get to the functional state. But the intentional explanation isn't the full explanation. There is a non-intentional part of the process, which is the Darwinian natural selection mechanism operating in capitalist markets. So the capitalist market case gives you, I think, a pretty good argument for why profit maximizing among firms cannot be adequately explained only by reference to the purposes of the actors. The purposes do play a role, so it is not a process empirically which works entirely behind the backs of actors. It does work through their intentions. But the intentions are, in a sense, hostage to the structural environment. The intentions are reinforcers, facilitators, executors of a set of pressures which are operating independently of those intentions. Yeah.
So how do you know that if the capitalist firms are just choosing randomly out of a book that they're actually chasing maximum profit? Maybe they're just maybe the strategy that they pick makes more profit than their competitors, but that's not objectively the most profit they could be making.
Well, of course, you never know, even if it's intentional, you never know that it's actually the maximum profits that could be made. All that you know is that there's pressures to make more profits. So there's preference not just to break even and make the smallest possible profit. There's pressures on firms because of competition. This is what we were talking about in that earlier discussion. That's part of the dynamic. If there are nonlinear returns, you know, if it's, say, increasing returns to scale for any reason, then firms which make higher rates of profit will be at a competitive advantage. If you really, you know, if you do have an economic world in which you have linear returns to scale and these power effects of size also are not important, then there's no reason why an individual capitalist firm that's private, that's owned by its operator, would have to maximize profits. They would still have to make profits. So there would still be, regardless, you know, their purpose, if they happen to have the purpose of just having a good time, they're likely to go out of business. There will be a selection, even in the linear returns to scale world, there'll still be pressures to be profitable, but not to be profit maximizers. But if there's non-linear, that is, if there's increasing returns to scale for whatever reasons, then, in fact, there'll be pressures on firms to grow. not just to make profits. And to grow means you have to make more than just breaking even. You have to do better than breaking even, which pushes you in the direction of profit maximizing. Now, the thing to note here is that is the close analogy to the Darwinian type mechanism in competition, and that's because natural selection does this fantastic trick. It selects for functional relations independently of any motivation. The animals in Darwin's story don't have a motivation to have the mutations to get the longer neck to eat the acacia leaves. Note the difference between Darwinian and Lamarckian evolution. So this is a good thing to put into your general, you know, repertoire of big ideas from the history of thought, which you may or may not have encountered in a biology class or some other way. There is a competing theory of evolution to Darwin, which is still a natural, it's not creationism, it's a natural explanation, identified with the name of Lamarck, L-A-M-A-R-C-K. Lamarckian evolution has the following structure. Take the giraffe case. Why is the neck of the giraffe long? Well, short-necked giraffes stretch their necks because they wanted to eat a little higher. And their children had the acquired attribute of the parent. So if the parent stretches its neck a little bit, then its children, its offspring, will have longer necks. And then they can stretch it a little bit more, and their offsprings will have a little bit longer necks. And even if the increments are tiny, the increments are not the result of random mutation. They're the results of acquired attributes from the previous generation. Interestingly, this is a famous episode in the history of science. And during the Stalinist period in Russia, where there was an attempt to encompass the science of nature within dialectical materialism, so there was this idea that all of history, the history of nature as well as the history of civilization, could be subsumed under the same kind of framework. And there was this very strong kind of teleological notion of progress. Stalin bought into Lamarckian and was opposed to Darwinian explanations because it coincided with the idea of socialism in one country. Through will and through effort, you could change the world by stretching your neck. And so Stalin repressed Darwinian evolution. It's one of the reasons why Soviet biology, unlike Soviet physics, was retarded. It was blocked because of the political repression of the correct scientific view. Lamarckian theory then brings intentionality, so to speak, into nature itself. Whereas, in fact, that's not the correct way of understanding. Okay, so that's the contrast intentional functional. Chris, you had.
I was going to say, actually, kind of what you said, but my issue is that it seems like these functional explanations only work in the presence of some sort of mechanism like natural selection that explains. I mean, without that mechanism, it wouldn't seem to be a logical explanation. It just would seem to be circular.
Okay, so the question, that's a really important question. Is there any. So, The competition example is a good one because it does give us some kind of mechanism that has at least sufficient autonomy from the purposes of the actors that we can say it adds real weight to the explanation. So note in that case, it's not that that the intentionality of the actors has to disappear. That is, empirically, because capitalists markets are competitive and people are smart and they know they're competitive, they may adopt, rather than randomly select from the manual of possible strategies, they may look for the better ones. But they're forced to look for the better ones because of the nature of the market. And that's the sense in which intentionality is in aid of the functional explanation rather than in opposition to it. Right? Because they're both operating in the same direction. The question is there any other mechanism that can work in this way so that we have a broader scope for functional explanation? What about the Trobriand Island case? So in the Trobriand Islands, it's not exactly a competitive context. There are competitive contexts with communities and societies in hunting, gathering areas there, or in agrarian civilizations, or various kinds of, quote, tribal contexts. Communities are at war with each other, they are raiding each other, there's various kinds of competition between them. And so one might argue that if one community has a set of maladaptive social forms that reduces its solidarity, they become more vulnerable to predation by other communities. And if you get enough time and you have enough communities, then functional defensive apparatuses, various ways of organizing communities that enable them to survive in the face of competition from other human communities, you could have a functional pressure. But that seems a little, it seems a little far-fetched. To see it all operating through these Darwinian mechanisms doesn't seem quite credible. So the question then is, are there other ways in which functional adaptations could occur that are not reducible to the intentions of actors, but in which the intentions of actors can play a role? So like in the Trobriand Island case. Lachelle. Yes, now note I think you've said it just right, and then to give it a little more theoretical standing, we need to add a couple of words. The example was a good one, and I think the words that need to be added are trial and error.
Yeah.
So another way that you can end up having the actual effects of something explain its presence is if the actors involved don't really know what's best, but they keep trying. They stop trying for new solutions once they get new solutions that work well enough. And the well enough is because of the actual effects of those solutions, not because of simply the beliefs in those effects. Not just because of anticipated effects, but because of actual effects. So in the Trobriand Island case, as in the case you just gave, presumably, there was a time before there were elaborate fishing rituals. It's not the case that those just were there from primordial times. And we know that it's just not plausible that, because the Trobriand Islanders originally were Asian mainlanders. they did migrate from the mainland at some point in, I think, 5,000 or 6,000 years ago I think it's more like three. The Pacific Islands were populated, I think, about 3,000 years ago, something like that, roughly in that time frame. So people came from a place where there was no such deep water fishing rituals, because there was no deep water fishing. They migrated, and in the course of that migration, island hopping, they develop ritual practices. And the most likely way is it was done through trial and error, that it was incrementally increased, that there were geniuses, brilliant shamans, brilliant in the sense of very attuned to the emotional life of their communities and what did and did not make people at ease and capable of doing the experiment. So this is storytelling. We don't have direct evidence of this but the storytelling has a certain plausibility. Note that this is a little Lamarckian. That is, the trial and error model in which the successful trials get replicated over time and the unsuccessful ones get abandoned and a new trial occurs, as opposed to communities with successful trials survive and those with unsuccessful ones die off. The Darwinian mechanism is that communities that have successful trials replicate and communities that have unsuccessful trials disappear. The Lamarckian version is communities that have unsuccessful tries try something else, so that on average the adaptiveness of communities increases over time. But that does require a role for purpose, intentionality, agency, plays a more active role in that kind of explanation. My own view is that social functional explanations always have a more prominent role for human purposes than do biological functional explanations. But they are still not reducible to those purposes. They're not reducible to the purposes because it's in fact the real effects of these policies, these practices, these rituals that consolidate their presence, not merely the anticipated effects. And that's the reason why it remains a kind of functional, at least you might want to say a quasi-functional explanation if you want to preserve the full bore functional explanation argument to cases where there's no intentionality, then these are quasi-functional explanations. Yeah?
But what about like when it comes to the development of the productive forces in society? For example, like talking about how computers have evolved like in today's society, isn't it true that first through some experimental method of trial and error, like these laws of physics that govern the ways in which the possibilities of computing govern what those are? But isn't it true that there's some level, it is in fact the level of intentionality that gives the forces of production its impetus and direction?
Well, we'll be discussing the forces of production problem and how functional explanations fit into that in a moment. The key, just to though anticipate that argument, the key argument around forces of production is that we explain the relations of production, let's say the social structures within which those forces of production develop. We're not explaining the forces of production, its development. We're explaining the relations within them which they develop. We explain those relations by the fact that they encourage the development of the forces of production. So the forces of production develop sometimes because people put their minds to it and decide, yes, we want to improve these forces of production, and they work and they struggle and they think and they do research, and aha, they come up with a new technology. The question is, what enables them to do all that stuff? You know, it's not the case that in all circumstances all of those brain activities can be devoted to developing the forces of production. The functional argument then is that you explain the nature of the relations by the extent to which they encourage that kind of thinking. But we'll get to that in a moment. Okay, functional intentional explanation. I think that's pretty clear now. One other little point that we've actually pretty much, I think, covered this. Functional explanation versus functional description. In fact, that's what we've been just doing, if we've been distinguishing functional explanations from pure functional description. A pure functional description is the hollow bones of birds enable the birds to fly. That's just a description of what the consequences of the bones are. It's not yet an explanation of why those bones are hollow. What a functional explanation does is say we can add to the functional description an explanation that's directly tied to that description. Now, if you ask why is the shape of an airplane wing the way it is, the answer is that it is necessary for the wing, for the plane to fly, for it to have that shape. But that's obviously incomplete, because you really have to say, and engineers know this, and that's why they designed the wings that way. The whole debate between creationists and evolutionary biology, which has evolved, in quotes, to a debate between intelligent design and Darwinian evolution, that whole debate is, you could not get the kind of fine-tuned complexity of the functional fit of all the organs and features of living things without there being a designer. There has to have been an engineer, similar to the engineer that explains the shape of the airline wing. So that the biologist's attempt to have a non-intentional explanation of complexity in the natural world fails, the intelligent design people say, because the complexity is so great it could never happen through random mutation and natural selection. In effect, they're invoking God as the explanation for things. God is the eternal divine engineer, because they believe that a natural, non-purposeful, non-intentional explanation simply could not produce this kind of complexity. The example that's often given, because it was an example posed to Darwin in his era, was if you were walking along the beach and you found a fine pocket watch, you would assume that it was made by some intelligent person. You know, you'd see all the gears intermeshing and whatever, that you would see this would have to have been produced by intelligence. It could not have just been a random event. And yet we observe living animals, which are much more complicated than pocket watches, and yet Darwin insists they're produced by natural selection. That's supposed to be a knockdown argument. and it just turns out to be wrong as a knockdown argument. You don't need a divine watchmaker in order to produce natural organisms. There was a time when other natural phenomena, non-biological phenomena, people felt they had to be explained by some kind of purpose, and now we no longer believe that. So it used to be, in answer to the question, why does the sun shine on Earth? The answer was because we need warmth. So it's clearly an effect of the sun shining and the Earth being where it is relative to the sun that we are able to survive on this planet. So that is a functional description, right? The effects of the sun are beneficial to life on Earth. There was a time before modern science when people felt that there needed to be an explanation for that beneficial effect. Why does the sun shine? Because God realized that the Earth needed warmth in order to support life, and therefore God designed the sun and the Earth to be 93 million miles apart and rotate in this way so as to provide the necessary conditions for life. What we now believe is that there's 100 trillion zillion stars, that's a way underestimate, in the universe, with gazillion numbers of planets, and only on a select few does it happen randomly that the radiation and distance and ecological circumstances are such that life would be possible. And we happen to be on one of these, but that's no big deal. That's just one of these random things that happens in the history of the universe. It's probably happened many other places, although we have no direct evidence for this, but just statistically we think it's likely. And once it happens, you get evolution sufficient for there to be conscious creatures, they're going to want to explain why it happened. And the earliest explanations they're likely to produce are these divine functional explanations, or divine intentional explanations, basically. You know, there has to be a designer for such things. Okay. One final bit about functional explanations, and this is the distinction between functional explanations and what can be called epiphenomenal attributions, epiphenomena. That's a nice bit of esoteric jargon. You'll hear from time to time criticisms of the Marxist tradition that they treat all non-economic phenomena as epiphenomena. So if you say the economic structure explains ideology, right? So the economic structure explains ideology. That's a common kind of Marxian type explanatory claim. Some people then say that means that Marxists think that ideology is an epiphenomenon. Now that's a completely wrong-headed accusation. It's not that it couldn't be true, but it just isn't a correct diagnosis. Epiphenomena, that word, means a consequence of something that itself has no consequences. So it's irrelevant. It's a kind of surface phenomenon that's an illusion. It doesn't have any consequences. It's an epiphenomena. If you say that's epiphenomenal, you basically means we can ignore it because it doesn't have any consequences of its own. When Marxists say that ideology is explained by the economic base, what they mean is ideology is massively important for stabilizing the economic base. Ideology has huge consequences for shaping the people who live in this economic world. The particular consequences it has is to make that economic world sustainable. It reproduces those economic relations. Those are huge effects. But those effects are themselves explained by the functional requirements of the economic system. So functional explanations assign massive importance to the things they explain. When you say that the hollow bones of the wings of birds are explained by the fact that it enables birds to fly, by those effects, you only believe that because the hollow bones have huge consequences for the survival of birds, for their adaptiveness to the environment in which they live. To say that the economy explains ideology functionally is to say ideology matters. It's not to say ideology isn't important. So whenever you get a functional explanation in the Marxian type functional explanation, you're actually assigning a lot of importance to the things you're explaining. They're not just effects. They're effects that are necessary for the survival of the system. And the expression necessary for the survival of the system, they reproduce class relations, they stabilize capitalism, they provide the conditions for accumulation, all of those kinds of words assign great importance to the things that you're explaining. Now, this is particularly relevant for the base superstructure kind of argument, which is a classical way that Marxists have talked about the relationship between the economic structure, the base, and ideology, the state, politics, and a whole range of other things. The base explains the superstructure, but it does so in a way that assigns tremendous power and importance to the superstructure, not one that treats it as an epiphenomenon. So again, this is mainly to clarify some words, the word epiphenomenon in this kind of context. And when you hear people raising that criticism of Marxism, it's just incorrect. It may still be capturing a valid objection to Marxism, namely, it may not be the case that the economic structure explains ideology. That has to be established. But the word explains in that context means functionally explains. And functionally explains means it assigns great causal importance to the thing which is being explained. And this is why functional explanations are really tricky. I mean, you can see the complexity here, because we're so used to explanation having this simple cause-effect character. When you explain something, you're explaining it by the antecedent causes of it in a straightforward, temporally linear way. But functional explanations are not like that. They imply a system of interconnected parts with iterated causal processes, and then some kind of selection mechanism or quasi-selection mechanism, you know, something of the sort we've been talking about, which explains how all this comes to be, how this configuration is generated over time. But then the analysis of it does have this character of having something that looks like reducing the ideology to the economic base, reducing in the sense of fully explaining it by, and yet according it tremendous causal importance. And that seems like an odd thing to do until you really decipher its components. Yeah?
So ideology works to stabilize the economic base. Can it work in the opposite relation to it, to destabilize the economic base? So kind of the superstructure kind of undermining the base.
Right. So the initial setup of the whole story is functionalist. Right. So we're going to get that straight. We're then going to criticize the pure functionalist version on a variety of grounds. And one has to do with the complexity of these non-economic institutions and structures, and the fact that they're too complex to be fully functionally explained, that is, to have all the parts contributing to the stabilization of the base. And the form of that complexity actually allows for contradictions to occur, particularly in a context of struggles. And when we get to the sections of the course on the state and ideology, that will be one of the central themes, the way in which social struggles and various sorts can actually generate, both within the state and within an ideology, internal contradictions within those fields, such that it doesn't all work so neatly, that ideologies can be subversive of class relations as well as reproductive of them. And then this leads into what is, I think, a rich but another one of these difficult kind of domains, the discussion of hegemony. Just to again prefigure some ideas from later in the course, a system can be described as hegemonic, the ideology is hegemonic, not just dominant, when it is sufficiently cohesive and integrated as to basically push out those kinds of contradictions, to make them fringe issues, so that the ideology seems unassailable. And then the question is, if you're opposed to the dominant structure and you feel that it creates all sorts of havoc in the world, how do you struggle against a structure that has this hegemonic character? That's a big problem. Capitalism turns out to be a very robust system precisely because, in many ways, it's able to create this hegemonic form, not just dominant form, of rule and of reproduction, which is much stronger and flexible kind of edifice. It continually rebounds from what seems to be, you know, unsustainable forms of contradiction and crisis. And that's what grappling, however, in whatever ways we can, with this problem of hegemony rather than just dominance. Again, just to prefigure language and issues we'll be grappling with, often the word hegemony is used as if it meant just really, really dominant. You know, actually, I think the term should be thought of as a contrast to simple domination. So it's true, hegemonic systems are dominant. I don't mean to suggest that they're not, but it's really a different logic of domination from simple domination. And it's a logic that's much harder to struggle against, but we then have to think about, since despair doesn't seem like a constructive option, we have to seek ways of thinking through the points of entry in a world in which you live in a hegemonic system as opposed to a world in which you simply have to contend with a dominant system. And hopefully we'll get some clarity on that, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks from now. It's like a soap opera, you know, I keep anticipating the... And eventually I run out of the ability to say, to answer questions by saying, we'll deal with that later, so, yeah. What I would say is this. One of the, I don't remember offhand if it's a suggested reading or a core reading. There is a very productive debate between Jerry Cohen, G.A. Cohen, and Jan Elster in the context of this book about the nature of functional explanation. They had a really interesting debate about these issues. So if you're interested in philosophy of science, it's certainly something worth reading. Yeah. Jan Elster, E-L-S-T-E-R. He's a Norwegian philosopher, political scientist, sociologist. He's a kind of Renaissance. J-O-N. J-O-N. Jan Elster. Jan Elster, if you want to just put on your to-do list of books eventually to read in the course of your, you know, meandering educations, he has two superb books he wrote in the 1970s. He's written many, many interesting books, but at least two that I found extremely interesting. One is called Ulysses and the Sirens, and the other is called Sour Grapes. And these are books on the problem of rationality and irrationality, and how rationality and irrationality figure in our social explanations. They're really wonderful books, very readable, clever. I mean, sometimes they're, as they say, too clever by half, but he's very good at clever, interesting formulations and getting to the core of pretty complicated arguments. We will read quite a bit from a book of his called Making Sense of Marx, which is a book that many Marxists find infuriating because it's so... He adopts a methodological stance, which he labels methodological individualism as a way of interpreting Marx. And that runs so much against the grain of the way most Marxists think about their own intellectual practice that some people find it really annoying. For whom that is your gut reaction when you read it, I think you should just relax and kind of just relax about it. Just enjoy the tour de force of his analysis and draw from it what I think is very insightful interpretations, even if they're not always faithful to Marx. You know, that's a secondary issue in a way, for in my judgment. It's a very rich and interesting treatment. So Jan Elster is a big critic of functional explanations because he thinks they lack what he calls micro foundations. And Jerry Cohen is a defender of them. Now, in terms of Juhi's question, which is, how should we think about a functional explanation that lacks these mechanisms? I think a functional explanation without the feedback mechanism or the selection mechanism or something like that should be thought of as incomplete, but not necessarily wrong. Explanations can be incomplete without being therefore deemed incorrect. An example would be when you, and this is an example that Jerry Cohen uses, for ordinary causal explanations. When you strike a match against a rough surface on a matchbox and the match bursts into flames, it's a perfectly reasonable explanation to say the match burst into flame because it was struck against the rough surface that caused friction and heat. Even though you don't know what the chemical composition of the match head is, what the specific temperature needed to be to set the phosphorus on fire, even if you've never heard of phosphorus, you know, you don't have to know anything about the chemical composition of that process, that which are the mechanisms. That's the mechanism by which friction causes the match to burst into flame. So you have a little black box explanation there. But you have an observational You have enough observational data from the many times you've struck matches under varying conditions to have a pretty good theory with a lot of evidence to back it up that the causal process begins with friction and ends with the flame, and that there is some mechanism that translates the heat generated by the friction into the flame, and that that's where the causal mechanism is located, even though you can't actually specify it. Now, what Cohen says is that's a good explanation for the match burning. It's just not a fully complete one. And even when you figure out phosphorus, it's not fully complete because there's some quantum mechanical processes operating within the within the atoms of the phosphorus that actually explain why it works the way it works. So, of course, mechanisms go all the way down. There's lots to be learned by completing the explanation. But in the phosphorus case, knowing those internal mechanisms may not improve your actual explanation at all with respect to the striking of matches. It just deepens it, but it doesn't mean that your ability to predict and your understanding of the conditions for will change. Now, it might, so that we know that when the match head gets wet, it doesn't work as well. And it might be that knowing more about the internal mechanisms could help you understand the failure to strike. But it might not, right? So anyway, functional explanations have this character. Now, the asterisk, the little coda to this is, because, and I think this is probably part of our hardwiring, as thinking creatures, our neurological cognitive capacities, because human beings, I think, are always seeking the meaning of things, that is, we want explanations of a certain sort, functional explanations are a kind of explanation that we can do very glibly. That is, I think we're suckers for functional explanations. So we have to be wary of them. There's a temptation to explain everything functionally. Everything has to fit together in some system, as opposed to lots of things are just the way they are through a set of muddled, chaotic processes that don't have any meaning. They just happen to be the way they are. They don't fit together well. So functional explanations are often self-serving. They're often glib. This is true in biology. A lot of what you see in evolutionary explanations are people telling just-so stories. The expression just-so stories comes from Rudyard Kipling's stories about why the leopard got its spot, why the spots, why the rhinoceros' skin is wrinkled, where the elephant got its trunk. So these are just stories that you tell without any real evidence. So the reason why mechanisms can be important is because they can debunk bad functional explanations. But none of that means that functional explanations should be discarded. It just means they need to be interrogated. Yeah.
And a functional understanding of history implies a functional understanding of lots of societal structures that go along with that, right? It kind of dictates that you also have functional understandings of how those systems work.
Right. Yeah.
So my question is just like, when it comes to the project of transformation, when it comes to the project of, for example, if you take the match example of moving from a situation where you don't have a match to a situation where you have a match that you can use for a particular function, or a situation where you have a match but you have a new situation in which you have to, it would be beneficial, structurally beneficial for you to have a match that functions better. Is it not an implicit necessity for the mechanism by which that match functions to be an integral part of the transformation?
Well, I mean, I would be hesitant to make any general rule about this. It generally seems true, the more you know, the better, right? The more you know about how things work, the more you have a full understanding of deeper mechanisms, the more likely when you want to change something that you'll get it right. But sometimes all of those details are just unnecessary additional parts of knowledge. They don't actually come into play in your understanding of the conditions for change. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. I don't think there is any general rule. We often have solutions to problems in which we don't fully understand the mechanisms through which those solutions work. So a good example in the biological case is that we've known for decades, and if you take the Native American precursors generations, that aspirin originally came from a bark of a tree that Native Americans chewed when they had certain maladies. And it turns out that the acetylsalicylic acid in the bark is what did it. And I mean, the Native Americans didn't know anything about acetylsalicylic acid. And neither did the initial pharmacological research that extracted it. I mean, they only named it after they, you know, fully decomposed it. But it took until very recently, there was not knowledge as to exactly why it reduced headaches or why it reduced inflammation. You know, they just didn't understand the pathways through which that causal process worked. Now, knowing that pathway, we presume in medicine, enables us to develop more effective analgesics of different sorts, because now we know what the targets are and how they work. Sure, but aspirin for generations was a great problem solver. You know, it helped many of us get through otherwise miserable moments. By virtue of knowing that it had desirable consequences, figuring that there was a pathway through which it did it, but we didn't need to know what the pathway was. And it's another example, that's also a useful example in a sort of different rhetorical context for why sometimes to solve a problem you don't have to know even what the cause of the problem was. So you have a headache. The headache could be caused from a hangover or from stress or from sleeping badly, or from whatever. Aspirins can be beneficial for all of those, regardless of the cause, and you don't have to undo the cause in order to solve the problem. So it's not always, you know, this is just part of the complexity of the way systems work. There are ways to intervene that may not undo the cause. This is a big issue around social conflict, social struggles. So if you're a Marxian, if you have a Marxian type critique of American society and you feel that capitalism is at the core of the systematic harms that are produced in all sorts of arenas, one conclusion is we have to get rid of capitalism. Another conclusion is we need better aspirin. Right? So that is, we can't get rid of capitalism, but we sure as hell can do things to neutralize some of these disastrous effects of capitalism, even while staying in capitalism. And then the functionalist counterpart is, no, you can't. If you neutralize these harmful consequences, it actually destroys capitalism. That the aspirin are incompatible with the reproduction of capitalism, so to speak. So that's the reformist versus revolutionary debate. The revolutionary argument is, no, all of these reforms that seem to neutralize the effects of capitalism either undermine the sustainability of capitalism or they're ineffective. That you cannot have a sustainably effective amelioration of life under capitalism because it'll disrupt the functioning of the base superstructure relationship and all the conditions of existence of capitalism. It'll either do that or it's going to get undone. It's not going to be robust. It won't stay in place. So there's no aspirin solution. You've got to stop drinking if you get hangover, so to speak. All right, I think this is the end of the functional explanation part. The next bit is the bridge into how does all this actually work in historical materialism. As we've got this functional explanation, I think we've broadly got an understanding of how this kind of explanation works. Now the trick is, how do you put this together to produce a grand theory of history? That's the task that Jerry Cohen sets himself to. And I think we should take our break and reconvene at 10 after. And we will enter that domain then. All right, so now we're ready to launch into historical materialism. The functional explanations are a way of reconciling two sets of propositions which, in the absence of functional explanations, seem at least somewhat contradictory. These are, I wrote them out in the outline. So the first pair are the following. The level of development of the productive forces in a society explains the nature of its economic structure. The level of the forces of production explains the economic structure. And the second part of this first pair is, the economic structure of a society has the effect of furthering the development of the forces of the productive forces. So that's a kind of odd pair. The level of the productive forces explains the economic structure. The economic structure explains the development of the forces of production. And the second pair is, the economic structure explains the nature of its superstructure. And the superstructure of a society has the effect of contributing to the stability of the economic structure. Now, the argument that Cohen makes is that these two pairs are internally consistent if the word explains in the left-hand proposition means functionally explains. So if you just substitute the word functionally explains in the first sentence, then the two are reconciled. The economic structure takes the form that it takes because this has the effect of furthering the development of the productive forces. That would be the functional explanation for the first pair. The superstructure takes the form it takes because this has the effect of contributing to the stability of the economic structure. That's functionally explained in the second pair. I'm going to focus in this discussion here on the first of these pairs, that is the functional explanation of the connection between the productive forces and the relations of production. Because this is the part of the overall story that gives us some purchase on the overall historical trajectory of the system. That's the dynamic core that gives you a directionality to history. The base superstructure part of the core explanation we will focus on more when in the parts of the course when we're talking about the state and ideology. That's where the base superstructure functional explanation figures most prominently. Here we're going to focus on the productive forces, productive relations part of the argument. This has come to be thought of as a technological determinist view of the general theory of history. Technological determinism is seen as a pretty crude kind of explanation by most social theorists. What Cohen wants to argue is that actually technological determinism is a deep theory, not a kind of superficial mechanical theory. Technological determinism is a deep theory, not some kind of glib, popularized, vulgar theory of history. One point I want to just clarify from the very beginning so that we just don't get bogged down in unnecessary aspects of the debates around technological determinism. Technological determinism is not hardware determinism. That is, it's not arguing that physical things, machines, determine social structures. It's a theory that argues that our knowledge of the world and how it works determines social structures. It's actually a cognitive theory, if you will, of history. It's knowledge about how to transform nature that is the key causal process here, not just the physical embodiment of that knowledge that's doing the causal work. Cohen has a very nice, simple formulation of this point at one point in his discussion of the meaning of the forces of production. He gives the following little, this is what philosophers do, right? So imagine the following two worlds. Britain in the 1960s. If all the machines and technology of Britain disappeared, you know, if we had a kind of apocalyptic rapture and all the machines went to heaven as opposed to the people, right? So we are suddenly in a world where we have no technology other than that which hunters and gatherers had. We had our hands and we have our intelligence. But every other aspect of our technology has just vanished. There would be starvation, massive chaos, terrible deprivations, but within a few generations, we'd be more or less back to where we were, so long as we didn't lose the knowledge of production. That is, if, you know, it's possible that the chaos would be so horrendous that all the knowledge would disappear. But if you retained the knowledge and lost the machines, you'd be able to recreate the world which had disappeared. Now imagine the opposite. We have all this fancy technology. We have computers. We have steel factories, oil rigs, and all the knowledge of the last 10,000 years disappeared. We'd be back to being hunters and gatherers instantly, and it would take thousands of years to recreate the world in which we had, the world we had lost. Now that's, you know, it's a simple exercise. It's so obviously true, you know, it's true in the right stylized way, that it's clear that what's doing the explanatory work is our knowledge, our understanding about how to transform nature. And that's also what develops in history. The key thing that develops is our know-how, our knowledge about how to transform nature. And of course, we embody that knowledge in physical capacities, in physical objects, because that turns out to be the best way of using that knowledge in order to improve our capacity to transform nature. But it's the knowledge that develops over time. And it's also, knowledge has this cumulative character. The reason we can say you have more of some of it, the reason why it has a metric, is because knowledge builds on knowledge. New knowledge takes old knowledge as its raw materials and it transforms it through the addition of new observations, new trials and error, new empirical efforts to produce better knowledge. So knowledge has this cumulative character. It's pretty rare in history, although it's not that it never occurs, that knowledge gets lost. It does happen. There are historical moments of disruption that are sufficiently severe and the means of transmission of knowledge sufficiently weak that knowledge gets lost. In the transition from the Roman Empire to the Middle Ages in Europe, it's often argued that knowledge was lost and it took, you know, hundreds of years to get back to where that knowledge base had been. But that's actually pretty unusual. It's not a standard case that once learned things are forgotten. The standard case is that once learned things are transmitted and then built on. Okay, so that's just the first kind of bottom line thing to get clear. What's developing in history is our knowledge about how to transform nature. That's the key. And then it gets embodied in hardware of different sorts, which of course is not incidental. I mean, that's what actually enables this knowledge to do its work, but it's not the thing which is most fundamental here. All right, so there's a number of steps in this argument. I've broken them down in a particular way. The five theses at the end of this exposition, this is under 5 under Roman numeral 4. The compatibility thesis, development thesis, contradiction thesis, transformation thesis, and optimality thesis. This is my way of ordering G.A. Cohen's argument. I and a philosopher colleague of mine, Andy Levine, we wrote a paper about Cohen And this is how we kind of reconstructed Cohen's argument. Those aren't Cohen's labels for his argument. This is my reconstruction of his argument. So let's begin. The first thing to deal with is this core central idea that there is at least a weak transhistorical tendency for the forces of production to develop. There's a tendency for the forces of production to develop over time. And this can be established not simply by the straightforward empirical observation that the forces of production have tended to develop. I mean, if we look at human history over the last 10,000 years, it's unmistakable that the forces of production 10,000 years ago were less developed than they are now. And if you look at it at 1,000-year increments, while there may the data for each of those 1,000 years may be sketchy, by and large, where you have data, the highest level of forces of production that you could find in the world at any point, not that it, at every place it develops, would be increasing over that 10,000-year period, especially rapidly in the last 1,000 years. And there'd be a couple of periods where you'd observe really important breakthroughs. And indeed, in historical accounts of human development, those big transitions get named. There's the Bronze Age, for example. That's signaled by a change in the forces of production, the discovery of how to melt the raw materials of ore to produce particular kinds of metal implements, which turned out to be enormously useful for various things, warfare, among others. So how does Cohen, as a philosopher, argue for this? Why should we believe that there is an intrinsic tendency? A tendency means there's some causal process at work, which doesn't act alone. It acts in an environment where all sorts of other things happen, but it acts with sufficient persistence that it will tend to produce these effects over time. The word tendency, it should be viewed not as a fudge factor. You know, it's not mainly designed to make it possible to deal with the fact that forces of production don't always develop. It's meant to be a more precise way of thinking about how this causal process works. It's always present, this set of mechanisms that would impel development of the forces of production. It's just that it doesn't always happen that it actually produces a development of the force of production, because other things are happening too, which may block it, which may reduce the pressure or whatever. Okay, so what does he say? Here's his formulation. Human beings live in a world of scarcity. That's the first thing. We live in a world of scarcity such that to survive, they must transform nature in various ways. So that's the first thing. This is a primordial fact about the human condition. We live in a world in which, in order to survive, we have to transform nature. Furthermore, we are the sort of creatures that have a capacity to respond to this condition of scarcity by improving the forces of production at our disposal. We have a capacity. Now, the capacity has two key elements, intelligence and instrumental rationality. So what do we mean by this? Instrumental rationality means that we adopt means to accomplish ends with understanding. Now, of course, every animal adopts means to ends. You know, that's what bees do when they go and hunt for pollen and then come back to the hive and do their wiggle dances to tell the other bees where the pollen is. The wiggle dance is a means of communicating the location of pollen to other bee creatures. But still, you wouldn't call that instrumental rationality. It's not There's no reflection. It's not with understanding. Instrumental rationality means that people have certain goals, certain ends, and they understand that there's a variety of possible means to accomplish those ends, and they try their best to pick the best, most effective means for given ends. That's instrumental rationality. Intelligence means we can figure things out. That we're not stuck with just habit as a way of adapting means to ends, but we have a capacity to figure out new ways of doing things. So intelligence is a neurological attribute. This is a part of our essence, and Cohen wouldn't have any problem, I don't either, with saying there are essential features of human beings, and intelligence is one. By all evidence, intelligence hasn't changed much in human evolution in the last, 10, 20, 30,000 years. Our basic neurological capacities seem pretty much the same over this entire period of time. When you look at the cave paintings of 35,000 years ago in some of these wonderful preserved caves, and the character of the artistic achievements in those cave paintings, it's brought home that actually we're not all that different from the people who did that painting. We can easily imagine ordinary contemporary people doing such things if they were in the right circumstances. So we have a capacity based on intelligence and rationality, and a necessity. We live in a world of scarcity. This capacity gives us an ability, it means the ability to respond to this condition of scarcity by improving our ability to transform natures, if only in a slow and haphazard way, in order to survive in a more satisfactory way. Now, the motivations for improving our ability to transform nature are multiple. Sometimes it's to reduce the physical toil of dealing with nature, but just as powerfully it's to reduce the risks of dealing with nature. I mean, I think it's really important to understand that the dilemmas, because we're intelligent, people know and knew when they were in hunting-gathering societies that there would be bad years. That's why hunters and gatherers constantly had to move. They couldn't stay, in many cases, in one particular place. There would be droughts, there would be fires, there would be all sorts of things that would make life difficult. And so there is an impulse to try to improve things in the insurance sense, reduce risks. But there's also the issue of toil and burden. If there's an easier way to accomplish the same thing, once discovered, people are likely to maintain it. So there are these discoveries that occur, and once they occur, their usefulness for people, and usefulness means they enhance our capacity to cope with our environment and to survive. And since we live in a world of scarcity and have to transform nature, mostly that's about our capacity to control nature, to enhance our survival. Once these things are discovered, they're so valuable that they're retained. Fire is one of the first of these. I'm just reporting the kind of standard sequences that are invoked in history about these things. The discovery of fire as a controllable resource. Initially, when fire occurred through natural causes, lightning strikes, for example, it was preserved. So before people fully understood how to make it, they still valued it. They recognized its ability to provide warmth. The discovery of fire increased the capacity of human beings to move to new places. Particularly once they learned how to make it. So once the discovery of fire led to an understanding of why it's valuable, why it's valuable has to do with its ability to both provide heat and its ability to cook food. then once it became viewed as valuable, then there was certainly an interest on the part of people to figure out how to make it. Now, I don't know if there's good archaeological evidence about the how long it took from the first efforts at husbanding fire. There were efforts to keep it going in small and contained ways once it occurred naturally. What the time gap between that and figuring out how to make it, I don't know. But certainly the search for a way to make it would have begun once people realized it could be kept. How does this dynamic actually work? This is still for the first thing. Why do the force of production tend to develop? By improving the forces of production, people gradually increase their capacity to transform nature such that eventually it becomes possible for people to produce more than a pure subsistence, the pure subsistence needs of the population, right? So if you can develop the force of production, eventually this increases your capacity to transform nature in ways that enables you to produce the means of existence beyond what's simply needed for your own population. Now, this doesn't mean that actual physical surplus will be produced. It simply means that there's a capacity to produce a surplus. The key inventions that are thought to have led to a capacity to produce a surplus center around agriculture, the discovery that you could plant seeds rather than merely harvest wild-produced seeds, and that you could domesticate animals rather than merely chase after wild animals. So domestication of animals and the discovery of the possibility of agriculture are seen as the key technical changes that made possible the production of a surplus. Now, again, the way to think about this is not that what we have is entrepreneurs existing 10,000 years ago who are engaged in research and development in order to figure out new ways of doing. It's not that in hunting and gathering societies there was some division of labor in which they had, you know, technological improvers as a role. Nor was it that anybody would spend a lot of time thinking about this. One can even think of it as more or less a kind of haphazard, even random thing, that somebody figures it out by accident and makes a small innovation, and then they see it works. It's a very pragmatic trial and error kind of thing. And once things work and are recognized as being of value to the security, reduction of risk, and the availability of time that people have, that is the reduction of toil. Once people learn this, then they pass on the knowledge. Things once learned are not generally forgotten. And eventually this does create the possibility of surplus. Now, when a physical surplus is producible, I think two sorts of things happen. First, there is an immediate and obvious incentive to develop technologies to store the surplus. And that's true in a self-contained, egalitarian community because being able to store the surplus is a form of insurance. That's the way you reduce risk. So storing surplus becomes important. Having domesticated animals, having more than you immediately need just for your consumption needs. It's also storing the surplus in the sense of having surplus animals. So being able to store surplus becomes an additional technological change. It's also part of changing your knowledge about how to transform nature, how to transform and keep the products of what you've transformed. That's one thing that happens. The other thing that happens is that there's a choice then that suddenly people have. They can either work just as hard as they always worked and accumulate this surplus, or they can increase their leisure. they don't have to work as much because they've got a surplus. They can produce the surplus and then draw down the surplus by working less time. Now, there's no reason, it seems to me, there's no reason to imagine any impulse that's endogenous to communities, once you can produce a surplus, to suddenly say, aha, now we can produce an even bigger surplus. And then now we can have a class society because we can pay for people out of the surplus who aren't going to be producing it. No, I think there's no reason to believe there's any impulse at all, any motivational impulse, for the production of a surplus to immediately generate a class form of relationships around that surplus. What it does do is create the possibility of classes. So you get, this is a key idea in this argument, that once a surplus can be produced and once it's stored, then it's possible to have a class of people who don't produce anything but who live off of that surplus. It's possible to have a class of people that don't produce anything but live off the surplus. Now, there'd be lots of reasons for the members of such a community to object to this and to resist it. You know, so you can imagine, now this is just so stories, right? You can imagine a period of history where periodically some family within this community now of... The form of such communities are typically combined hunting and gathering with small-scale agriculture. The initial transition to agrarian society is thought of as combining both modes, both hunting and gathering and settled agriculture. So you can imagine somebody in that community tries to set themselves up as a strong man, as someone who would engage in activities other than production and appropriate part of the surplus, and you can imagine the community objecting to it and preventing it from happening. So who knows what the actual micro dynamics in such communities were. But the possibility of a class structure emerges once a surplus is produced. This possibility increases once these agrarian technologies also discover fertile plains. That is, there is the discovery, and I don't know the exact historical sequence and what the time gap is from the earliest agriculture to the fluvial agriculture, that is the agriculture that occurs in these incredibly fertile areas, the Tigris, Euphrates, the Yellow River, the Nile Delta, these incredibly fertile areas. Once you figure out that you can plant seeds and then you can improve the quality of seeds because you see which plants grow better and you save the seeds from the best plants. Once you discover that, then the discovery that actually there's some incredibly good places to plant and nobody's planting there, so to speak, because this is the beginning of such civilizations, then the amount of surplus that you can produce goes up a lot. Now, exactly how class structures emerge out of this context, I don't think there's any way of having an unambiguous documentation, but probably warfare plays a really crucial role here. Because once a surplus is possible, all sorts of incentives occur to take the surplus from one community. And if you have specialized roles of raiders, you're more able to do this than if you don't have specialized roles of raiders. And the specialized roles of raiders get created over time through allocating part of the surplus, so to speak, to feed what then become warriors. Raids and intercommunal warfare were not a common practice among hunters and gatherers. It's not that there was no conflict, but it wasn't the kind of fabric of everyday life in the way that it becomes once you get settled agriculture, because there's more stuff to acquire. There's more incentives around this. Probably, my guess is that the emergence of classes is probably the result of intercommunal domination in the first instance. the subordination of one proto-agrarian community by another. That's probably the way in which class structures actually emerge in the context of the agricultural revolution. And then once that occurs, the need to build up an apparatus to control now the subject populations from whom one is appropriating part of their surplus generates the instrumentalities for a proto-state. That is a coercive apparatus needed to maintain over time the stability of the forms of surplus extraction that occur once you've been able to dominate one community by another. So one can imagine, again, this is what's called just-so stories, because the actual record of the details of this are not known. But one can imagine many attempts of one community to subordinate another, and it all falls apart because although they can initially do raids, there's too equal a balance of power, and it's too fragile a set of relations to sustain over time. And it produces lots of aggravation and disorganization, but it doesn't actually produce a stable new social structure of stable hierarchy. So for a long period of time, there was probably a high enough level of productivity to allow for exploiters without exploiting to actually emerge. Stable exploitation. But as a contingent event, from time to time, there would have been such efforts, and eventually some of them succeed stably enough. And it turns out it looks like they succeed stably enough in these fluvial agrarian regions, because those are the regions where, when they succeed, they're able to extract enough surplus to reproduce the structure of domination. That creates then a whole new structure of relations. And then the argument is that when you get that stabilized set of relations, then you get a real takeoff in the levels of productivity in those regions. That is, the level of productivity in the fluvial plains that were highly fertile and with these relatively limited technologies could produce huge surpluses. The ability to capitalize on that surplus production is enhanced once you get class relations. That is, once you get a class of actors who have a huge interest in maximizing a surplus extraction and using it to reproduce their power, rather than just using surplus as an insurance policy to reproduce the community as a whole. So prior to classes, a surplus is produced for purposes of insurance and toil reduction, but it's still an egalitarian system of sharing rather than exploitation. Once classes take advantage of this, they have an interest in increasing the productivity in this fertile area to increase the amount of surplus available to sustain the apparatus of rule. And that then stimulates a more rapid development of the forces of production than exist under the previous egalitarian regime. Because under this new inegalitarian regime, there is a driving incentive for higher productivity rather than just a passive, opportunistic taking advantage of increased productivity. Furthermore, once that is discovered in one place, those new apparatuses subordinate lots of communities in the surrounding area. They become dominant forces in these agrarian civilizations then that emerge in these very productive fluvial plains. And that's when, so to speak, quote, civilization begins, meaning the earliest forms of class domination. The typical form of class domination under those conditions is slavery. Slaves are primarily recruited through capture rather than through the production of slaves internally. So it's primarily the form of subordination of one community by another. Now, the functionalist argument is that when this happens, it leads to the more rapid development of the forces of production, and that more rapid development of the forces of production explains why those class relations become stable. So compared to the egalitarian communalist relations of production in the pre-class era, the hierarchical pre-capitalist class relations, based on some type of slavery or quasi-slavery or other forms of coercive subordination and coercive extraction of the surplus, those actually turn out to be a better environment for the subsequent development of the forces of production, because it creates these incentives to take advantage of existing forces of production more pervasively and to improve upon them. This is this clear? Do you see the logic here, how this works? Yeah.
I was wondering if you could just repeat the functionalist argument you stated a second ago.
So the general functionalist argument of the Cohen type with respect to this is that we explain the class relations by their ability to foster the development of the forces of production. In pre-class society, there are no classes. The existing social relations, which are pretty egalitarian, you know, a lot of details are being sloughed over here. They were somewhat patriarchal, but not as patriarchal as in agrarian societies, etc. But pretty egalitarian, let's call them communalist relations. Those fostered the very slow episodic development of the forces of production and their rational use, to the point where a surplus became possible. It was stored for insurance purposes. It was, in some ecologies, would reach some natural limit pretty easily. But in other ecologies, namely when this happened around fluvial estuaries, you know, in these very fertile valleys, once they figured out that much, then there was the potential for a huge surplus, but a potential that was not realized. The discovery of class relations through trial and error and imposition leads to an explosion of productivity. And that stabilizes these class relations. And therefore we can say, why are these class relations stabilized and become permanent features of the landscape in a kind of literal sense of this of these regions? It's because those class relations, and not the earlier ones, enabled the forces of production to develop in a way which created the big surplus which was needed to stabilize the class relations. So you get this kind of functional fit, which wasn't, of course, anyone's intention in this first transition. It's hard, you know, the intention here was just to gain power, to dominate people, to appropriate surplus, not to lead to trigger the development of the forces of production. But it's that triggering of the forces of production which stabilized these new class relations and made them permanent features of this landscape. Yes, Mitch.
So does the overarching functional explanation of history start when classes emerge? Or is there a functional aspect in that pre-class?
So in the pre-class relation, there is still a functional explanation in the sense of, you ask the question, why in these pre-class relations were the relations egalitarian? And the answer is they were egalitarian because those are the relations which allowed for the most optimal use of the existing forces of production and their slow development. So there was still a functional compatibility between the pre-class communal relations and the existing level of forces of production. And it was a compatibility that did allow for the slow development of the forces of production, under those conditions where the forces of production were developable. There was a Dan Shippey.
Yeah, I don't know how much this question is worth, but does that functional explanation then assume that the class relations which were obtained at the beginning of this explosion of productivity are automatically the best obtainable, or that they were simply out of the variety of class relations available, the best out of those, but not objectively
right.
the best that
right.
could be attained?
So on the evolutionary model, on the analogy with biology, it's the first of what you said. That is, biologists do not argue that each evolutionary step is the best possible evolution for that creature. It's just better than the other available ones. So evolution doesn't have a optimality claim. That's simply, a lot of vulgar evolution does. It says that every feature of a creature is the optimal one for that creature. No, I mean, a lot of them are remarkably adaptive, but a lot of things are kind of jerry-rigged best possible given all the constraints. And plenty of features of many creatures are not particularly good for the creature. It's just that there's no evolutionary alternative. So you're stuck with some pretty suboptimal things. I mean, we have appendicitis because we have an organ that used to matter and doesn't matter, but it gets infected. We have this big problem with the birth canal in women with large craniums of babies, which is the result of the disjuncture in the evolutionary development of pelvises relative to brains, so to speak. So it's not the case that the architecture of our body cavities, if we were engineers, it would be designed differently. You know, it's part of the argument against the intelligent design people is that if indeed this is intelligent design, then either the engineer has a perverse sense of humor or just lacks a certain basic competence. You know, that is, no engineer would design the inner ear in such a way as to guarantee that something like half of all infants get ear infections because of the size of the inner ear and its architecture relative to fluids and all this stuff, so that you get a mild cold and you get an ear infection. That's not necessary. You could have designed the inner ear in a way that would have allowed it to drain. But you couldn't have the evolution of our fine sense of hearing, which is, you know, a crucial part of our language ability comes from our sense of hearing. You know, all of that development occurred through a series of fortuitous mutations against architectural constraints, engineering constraints of the previous morphology. And it was good enough, but it has this problem. So, you know.
So, just to clarify, the functionalist explanation does allow for possibly better class relations, but that the ones that we get are simply the best ones that we can come up with.
Right. So, and that's a little, I mean, I make this optimality thesis in my exposition. I think Cohen seems to suggest it's the best possible. But partially his very crude typology fudges that. It's pre-class, pre-capitalist, capitalist, post-capitalist. So among all the possible pre-capitalist relations, we could imagine some that might have been even better. And which are humanly possible. They're not inconsistent with anything we know about human beings. But for all sorts of reasons, they weren't available at a particular place. Yeah?
What about, like, the division of labor class systems, yeah? And, like, what was the, like, we were talking about the biology of and how that can serve as a determining factor, but, like, for example, like, gendered division of labor and stuff like that. Is it not true that existed?
So there was a gender division of labor. Certainly all existing hunter-gatherer societies today that we can observe, you know, the remnants of what we assume to be somewhat like pre-class hunting and gathering societies of 20,000 years ago. That's an assumption. Is questioned by some anthropologists. Some anthropologists feel that the hunting and gathering societies observed in the 19th century that were observed in a, quote, pristine state in the sense that they were before Western contact might still have been nothing like hunting and gathering societies of 10,000 years ago. But assuming they were, they typically had gender divisions of labor, but pretty weak ones, and relatively little hierarchy built around that division of labor. So there's two phenomena to be explained. One is the division of labor, and one is the hierarchy around the division of labor. So it's true that women did not hunt, in general, big game. and particularly not when they had small children. Crying babies are not optimal for stalking woolly mammoths, to state it in a kind of caricatured way. Women did more of the gathering and the hunting of small game in the immediate vicinities of camps, and men did more of the long-distance hunting of large game. That division was there. Frederick Engels argues that that division underwrote the subsequent division of labor around animal husbandry, that men were responsible for large domesticated animals, and women not, and that that underscored the emergence of patriarchy because of the association of men with property rights. So that's a subsequent story. But in the hunting and gathering case, the general argument is that relatively little hierarchy was built around the division of labor. Some, but there was more hierarchy between elders, the councils and communities of elders, and that included women in many cases. It wasn't just elders of men. So, and that's the way we should think about it. I think we should end. We didn't get through all of this. We're at point four. We're at point three in the. We now have to get to what's the key bit in the argument. That's the functional explanation for the transformation of class structures, rather than just for the emergence of class structures. And we'll begin there, and then proceed through the rest of this lecture. Thank you.